It's a very dangerous room to put a rabbi in. It has no clock. I have a watch. Okay, I am flattered that you invited me here a second time for this mission. I know if it's the same faces. I'm sure I noticed some of you are the same. It a little bit intimidates me, though, because it reminds me of the Chazan who was asked to sing his last number a second time. They asked for an encore, and he sang it a second time. When he finished the second time, they asked him for a third time. After seven times singing the same number, he said, "I'm really flattered that you want to hear this number over and over again, but how many times?" And somebody in the back yelled out, "Till you do it right." So I hope this year I'll do it right and you won't have to invite me another time. In any case, I consider it an honor and a merit to be able to address you. I consider you all Noshim Gedolos, very important people. And that is not a term that I'm using just to flatter you, but it's really true. What defines a Gadol? Great person. So the Torah tells us what defined Moshe Rabbeinu when he became a Gadol. Torah says, Vayigdal Hayeled, the child grew. And then it says, Vayigdal Moshe, Moshe grew. The Ramban explains the first time he grew physically. And the second time means that he became an Adam Gadol, a great mature person. What quantified Moshe Rabbeinu being a great person? Torah tells us immediately after that. Vayetze el echo vayar besivlosam. He went out to his brothers and he saw their suffering. And Rashi says, what does that mean? He saw their suffering. Nosan eino velibo lios meitzer aleihem. He put his heart and eyes to suffer along with them. That is greatness. Somebody who can empathize with other people's troubles and other people's simchas and be concerned about more than just themselves. And you are here both to get inspiration and to be able to give over that inspiration in the communities that you live, and that makes you great people. Why is that greatness? Reb Shimon Shkop, in one of his svarim, the preface to one of his svarim, he raises the following question. On the one hand, we are mandated by the Torah to be concerned about ourselves. Self-concern is a legitimate mandate of Torah living. To the point where if you need tzedakah and someone else needs tzedakah and you only have enough for one, you can take the tzedakah. You're first. Charity begins at home. If you have an animal, a pet, that's running away, and your father, your mother, your Rebbe have a pet that's running away, you can only save one, you save yours first. Even if your life is in danger and other people's lives are in danger, and you can only save one, you save yourself first. So self-concern is a mandate, a legitimate mandate of the Torah. But you're not supposed to only be concerned about yourself. You're also supposed to be concerned about other people. So how do you balance those two concerns? Self-concern and concern for others. So Reb Shimon says it depends on what your perspective is on yourself. If you consider yourself from your toes to your head, then there's a very big conflict between self-concern and concern for all those other people out there. But some people are bigger than that. And they know that their spouse is mamish part of them. It's not somebody else, it's themselves. And when they're concerned about their spouse, they're concerned about themselves, except themselves extends to two bodies. Some people are bigger than that. And they realize their children are an extension of themselves. And when they're concerned about their children, they're not concerned about somebody else. It's self-concern, except that concern now is on many bodies. Some people are even bigger than that, and they understand that their extended family, uncles, aunts, cousins, they all are part and parcel of them. As Lavan said, Atzmiu besori ata, you are my flesh and blood. So when they're concerned about their extended family, they're really concerned about themselves. And some people realize their entire neighborhood is part of them. And some people, their entire city and their entire country. And some people realize the entire Jewish people or the entire world are part of them. And when they're concerned about all those other people, it's self-concern, because all of them are part of me. And then it's only a matter of priority. It's not me or them, it's all of us together, but then there are priorities of which part of me comes first. And if you think that's only semantics, it's not. You're all familiar with the fact that when Yaakov Avinu wanted to rest on the way running away to Lavan, so he took 12 stones, and he was going to use one of them as a pillow. And the stones began to argue, on which one of them will the tzaddik put his head? So the Rabban Shalom made a miracle, and he fused all of the stones together. Says the Chedushi Harim, the Ger Rebbe, doesn't make sense. If any one of the stones could have been a pillow for Yaakov, that means the stone was big enough for Yaakov to put his head on it. Now, if all the stones fused together, then that gigantic stone was 12 times the size of Yaakov's head. He's still going to only put his head on 1/12 of the stone. Why weren't they still arguing where he's going to put his head? He said as long as the stones were separate, it made a difference which stone Yaakov's head rested on. Once the stones were united into one stone, it didn't make any difference anymore if it was this part of the stone or that part of the stone. If you look at yourself as separate and disjointed from everyone else, then it's very, very difficult to have empathy and to be concerned about other people. It's a very big conflict. If you consider yourself part and parcel of everyone, and the greater a person is, the greater they consider themselves a part of more and more circles of people. And the person who considers himself part of the circle of humanity is the greatest person that can be. He is an Adam Gadol. And Rav Shimon says that's the meaning of a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Im ein ani li mi li. If I don't worry about myself, who's going to worry about me? I have to have self-concern that is legitimate. But kishani li atzmi, when my ani is just little me, from my head to my toes, mo ani, that's not my real being. My real being has to be connected to everyone. And I think that the word ani itself symbolizes that. How do you spell ani? Aleph, Nun, Yud. The Aleph is one, represents the individual. Yud is 10, that's a minion. That represents the community. How do you take the Aleph and the Yud and connect them and make that your person, your Ani, with a Nun? It says Moshe put his eyes and his heart. His eyes means his intellect, and his heart means his emotion. To really empathize with other people, you need two things. You need an intellectual understanding of their needs, because if you don't understand what they need and what really is good for them, you sometimes, in good faith, may be harming people. If a drug addict comes and begs for money so he can go and feed his habit, you're not doing him a favor by helping him. You'd be doing him a much better favor if you direct him to a clinic. So you need brains, you need intellect, you need to understand what the situation is. But that's not enough, because if you just understand something intellectually and you don't have a heart, and you don't have feeling, you're never going to empathize with anyone. If you only have feeling, then you may distort what a person may really need. So you need a combination of intellect and emotion. The intellect is represented by the 50 gates of wisdom. And the emotion is represented by the 50 gates of purity. That's a nun. The nun is 50. If you put that nun between the aleph, the individual, and the yud, the community, and you exercise your intellect and your emotion, then you'll be able to connect the aleph and the yud with that nun, with that 50 gates of wisdom and purity, and make that your ani, who you really are. So therefore, a person has to be concerned about other people. You're here to gain inspiration and perhaps the tools to be able to influence and inspire and help other people. However, it's also important that you inspire and influence yourselves. That same Moshe Rabbeinu, who was a great person because he cared about others intellectually and emotionally, it says Moshe Zocha the Zika Es HaRabim. First, Moshe himself merited. He grew. He had to be somebody who could then influence others. If he had nothing to influence others, then he had nothing to give. First, you have something to give. You have to be inspired. You have to be learned. You have to be people who have what to give over. And then you can give that over to others. The Vilna Gaon says there are two ways of filling a cup. You can take a cup and pour out its contents, but then the first cup is empty. Or you can take a cup and pour into it until it overflows and overflows and fills up many, many other things, and that original cup remains full. A cup in English is a vessel. A cup in Yiddish is your head. If you don't have too much in your cup, you can't influence too many other people. You'll exhaust everything you have very quickly. But if you keep filling up your cup with a lot of Torah knowledge and a lot of Torah emotion, then you'll be able to overflow into the cups of many other people. So therefore, I first want to speak about how you can reconnect or re-inspire yourselves and become enamored intellectually and emotionally with the Torah. So when you go back, your cups will be full and you'll be able to overflow to other people in your communities. Let me tell you an interesting svarno that sets the tone, at least, for the first stage of this. Moshe Rabbeinu is instructing the Jewish people as to what is going to be with the man that fell daily. And part of the instructions were, do not go out and collect man on Shabbos. There will not be no man. Don't collect it. There won't be any. And Jewish people, true to our nature, Moshe said, there won't be any. The Jewish people said, we don't believe you. We want to go see for ourselves. And they went out to collect man. Moshe said, don't collect. They went to collect. Okay. God gets angry. And he says to Moshe, Ad Mosai me antem lishmor mitzvosei. How long will you, the plural, including Moshe Rabbeinu, not listen to my directives? The obvious question is, what in the world did Moshe Rabbeinu do? He didn't go out to collect man on Shabbos. He told them not to do it. They did it. Should have said, Ad Mosai me anu. How long will they refuse to listen to me? Not you, plural. Says the Sfarno the following. Even though Moshe Rabbeinu did not go out with them to collect man on Shabbos, he caused them to do it. And he's to blame. Yes and no, even more than that. He said, all you told them was, don't go and collect man on Shabbos, there won't be any. What's human nature? You tell me no, I say yes. You say there won't be any, we're curious. We want to see if there's man or not. So what should have Moshe Rabbeinu done? You should have taught them the laws of Shabbos in depth and in breadth so they'd understand why you can't go out and collect man. What's wrong with collecting man on Shabbos? What exactly, which of the 39 activities that are prohibited on Shabbos is collecting the man? You should have taught them, given them a shiur in halacha. They should have appreciated what the problem is. And then you should have told them the hashkafa, What's the idea behind Shabbos? Why do you have to keep Shabbos? What's the depth and the breadth of the emotional, intellectual understanding of Shabbos? And then you should have told them the reward that accrues to somebody who keeps Shabbos and the punishment that comes to somebody who doesn't keep Shabbos. If you would have told them the breadth and the depth of halacha and the breadth and the depth of hashkafa and the breadth and the depth of Musar, then who could not keep Shabbos? But all you did was tell them, don't do it, it's not going to be there, and human nature is to resist that. So in order to be able to influence other people, you have to know yourselves the breadth and the depth of halacha. What's it all about? Why are these things prohibited or permitted? What are the parameters? So you can intelligently explain to somebody and give over to someone what the parameters of the mitzvahs of the Torah are. And then to understand the depth of as much as we can understand about those mitzvahs. And even though we don't speak about the reasons for mitzvahs, but we speak about the tastes of mitzvahs. If someone were to ask you, why do we eat? Why do we eat bread? The answer is because it's nourishing and we are human beings, and if we don't eat, we'll starve to death. Why bread? Because that's the way God made the world. That the nutrients in bread are nutritious, and we don't eat rocks, even though we gain weight a lot faster if we ate rocks, they don't have that nutrition. Why? I don't know why. That's how God made the world. He could have made the world where our nutrition comes from rocks. He didn't. He made it that it comes from bread. On the other hand, once we're eating, because God said that's what you have to do, because that's the way God created the world, beyond our comprehension, that's part of the nature of the world. God made the bread attractive, tasty. He gave it a taste so it would be tasty to us, so we would be able to also appreciate it, even though we don't know the reason why, but it is attractive to us, it's tasty to us, it's an extra added thing. The reason we eat the bread is not because it tastes good. Because you can take artificial flavors, put them on a piece of cardboard, and it'll taste better than any fresh baked bread. But if you eat that for a few days and nothing else, you'll die of starvation with a good taste in your mouth. And if the bread is stale and tastes like nothing, and that's all you have to eat, that still will give you the nutrition. So the taste is not the reason we eat. The reason we eat is because that's how God made us, and that's how He made the world, and this is what He made nutritious, and this is not nutritious. But once He made it that we have to eat, He wanted it to be palatable to us. He wanted it to be tasty. He wanted us to have a feeling for it too. And therefore He gave it a taste. The reason we keep mitzvahs is because that's how God made the world. And our neshamos, just like our bodies need bread, our neshamos need mitzvahs. Why this mitzvah? Why little black boxes on our head and not paisley boxes on our toes? Only God knows. No, nobody knows why. But once we're doing it, there can be a taste that we can appreciate it also. But it's only a taste. What's the difference? If the taste isn't there, the mitzvah still applies. But if the reason isn't there, then the mitzvah doesn't apply. So if you think you know the reasons, and then they say the reason doesn't apply anymore. I know why pig is awesome, because it gives trichinosis, and it's not really a clean animal. You should go see what cows look like when they're alive. Okay, they are not clean animals, and pig meat is very clean, and most goyim who go to fancy restaurants and order pork chops do not get trichinosis. And they pay good money for it, so it must really taste good. The reason is, that's what God said. God said, we're not allowed to eat it. Somehow it affects our neshama. How? I don't know. But it does. But once the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us the mitzvah, we can have a taste in it. And there are many, many tastes of why kashrus and what it teaches us, discipline or whatever the taste may be. But they're only tastes. And if the taste doesn't apply, the mitzvah still applies. If the reason doesn't apply, the mitzvah doesn't apply, and we don't know the reasons for mitzvahs. We know only tastes. In any case, so therefore, if a person would learn the parameters of what mitzvahs are and understand as much as they can what the halacha is, where it applies, where it doesn't apply, what the background is, what is the prohibition, and then understand the ideas, the tastes behind those mitzvahs, and then the reward and punishment, then who could not keep mitzvahs if they understand all of that? So if you want to be inspired, learn. That's the first stage. First stage is learn. Learn as much as you can. Learn halacha, learn hashkafa, learn musar, and then your outlook and your perspective and your understanding of what a Torah life is will be greatly enhanced, and then you'll be able to give it over to others. There's another important stage in this, and that's the following. At the Seder, and even though you women have been given a month-long respite this year, Pesach is 2 months away, not 1 month away, still, my wife is already cleaning for Pesach, because my daughter is expecting in Scotland right after Purim, and she does not want to leave me to clean for Pesach. Not because she has Rachmanis on me, because she has Rachmanis on our observance of the Torah. In any case, so at the Pesach Seder, the Chacham asks the following question. Moha Eidos v'hachukim v'hamishpotim asher tzivo Hashem Elokeinu eschem. What are all these laws that God commands you? Now, you can't understand the question simply, because if he doesn't know what the laws are, he can't be too much of a chacham, he can't be too much of a sage. So what is his question? Says the Ibn Ezra, his question is the following. The non-Jewish world have 7 mitzvahs that are relatively easy to keep. They're not allowed to murder, not allowed to steal, not allowed to serve idolatry, not allowed to be immoral, have to set up a justice system, not eat meat taken from a live animal, which is not one of the more tempting things that people do every day, tear limbs off of animals and eat them or whatever. And if they keep their 7 mitzvahs, they will get a share in the world to come. What did we do wrong that God laid this tremendous yoke of 613 mitzvahs on us more than anybody else in the world? Why us? Why can't we get away with 7? That's his question. Good question. What's the answer? We tell him the following. Avodim hayinu lefaro b'mitzrayim. Let's look at God's track record. He took us out of Egypt from being slaves. Did he do it for our sake or for his sake? Obviously for our sake. Took us through the desert for 40 years and took care of all of our needs. For our sake or for his sake? Obviously for our sake. Brought us to Eretz Yisrael, gave us this beautiful land. For our sake or his sake? Obviously for our sake. So if he gave us all these laws, it would follow that he did it for our sake, not for his sake. This is not a yoke. It's a opportunity. It's a present. God gave us the Torah and mitzvahs as an opportunity, not as a liability. Meaning the following. Rabbi Hananya ben Akasha said, Ratzah HaKadosh Baruch Hu lezakos es Yisrael. The Rabbanu Shalom wanted to merit the Jewish people. That is one interpretation. We'll see the second interpretation in a second. He wanted to merit the Jewish people, and therefore he gave us an abundance of Torah and mitzvahs. Torah and mitzvahs are a present. They're a merit. They are not a liability. There's another meaning to the word lezakos. Lezakos can also mean to purify. God wanted to purify our souls, and therefore he gave us an abundance of Torah and mitzvahs. Let me explain that. I didn't plan on explaining that exactly at this point, but now I see perhaps it's better to do that. What does that mean? Why did God give us all these mitzvahs? What's the great merit in having all these mitzvahs? In order to understand that, have to understand what the purpose of this world is altogether, what the purpose of life is altogether. So in a nutshell, rabbis tell us the following. God, in his infinite graciousness, God is the ultimate good, wanted to shower his goodness on a creation that could receive that goodness. So he created our souls. And that's what we are. We are souls. We are not bodies with little Casper the Friendly Ghost flitting around inside of us called a neshama. We are souls. We were created as souls. We existed for thousands of years under God's throne in a spiritual world as souls. And we only came into this world, each one in his proper time, and then we got a body. I always like to compare the body to a spacesuit. An astronaut, as long as he's on terra firma, doesn't need any special suit or apparatus to be able to function. But when he goes into outer space, he needs an oxygen apparatus to breathe because there's no oxygen there. He needs a pressurized suit because there's no air pressure. He needs a radio to speak through because there's no sound waves. When he comes back to Earth, takes off the suit, he's able to function again. As long as we were souls in a spiritual world, we could see without eyes and hear without ears and get around without arms and legs. But when our soul was put into the physical world, we needed a physical body to be able to function. We need eyes to see and ears to hear and so on. When we go back to that spiritual world, we leave the suit here, just like the astronaut takes off the suit when he comes back to Earth. Could be for that reason, one of the ways that we manifest and express mourning when somebody dies is by tearing our clothing. It's to show that it's only the clothing that's been torn away, but the essence of the person still exists. So God created us as souls, and he could have immediately created that showering of his presence upon us, which is the ultimate pleasure that exists. Eternal pleasure. That's what we call the world to come. Tzadikim yoshvim, tzadikim sit, v'atroseim b'rosheim, their crowns are in their head, v'nehenem miziv ha'shchina, and they enjoy basking in God's presence. God wanted to create a bond with our souls so we would have that eternal bond with him. That's the world to come. So God could have created souls, put them into this spiritual world to come, and that would be it. But God knew that if he gave us that pleasure, that bond, unearned and undeserved, we wouldn't appreciate it completely. It wouldn't be the ultimate pleasure. In order to be the ultimate pleasure, it has to be earned and deserved, because a person appreciates more what he earns and deserves rather than what he's given for free. Just as an aside, because you seem to be very intelligent women, there's a very big question you could ask on that. Maybe you're thinking about it. God could have saved a lot of time and money. He didn't have to create this world, put us here so we could create and deserve and earn our share of the world to come. He could have done something else. He could have created a soul that can appreciate things that doesn't earn. Who made that rule? God made the rule. He could change the rule too, couldn't he? So why didn't he make a world where souls can appreciate what they don't deserve and what they don't earn? The answer to that question is, there is no answer. But I'll tell you why there's no answer. That's also an answer. Our minds are very limited. Okay? And I'll prove it to you. We can only fathom things that are within our realm, that we have some connection to. Things that are outside of our realm completely, our minds can't fathom. Example. Close your eyes, not too tightly, because I do not want to be the only person here awake. Close your eyes and picture nothing in your mind. You have nothing pictured in your mind? Take your arm now and put it into that nothing. Is your arm inside that nothingness? That's not nothing. That's space. Try again. Nothing is no space. Don't even try. You get a headache. You can't imagine no space. You know why? Neither can I. You know why? Because we have no connection. We have no... It's out of our realm. There is no such thing as the world that we live in with no space. There's always space. So we can't imagine something we have absolutely no point of connection to. I'll give you another example. Imagine something you never saw and never heard of. It's impossible. Something you never saw and never heard of. What can you imagine? A monster with 10 heads, 6 arms, but you heard of heads and arms. You're just putting things that you saw and heard together. Something you never saw and never heard of is impossible to imagine because it's out of your frame of reference. And therefore, we're not allowed to... Our connection with God, even, is only from the creation of the world. The greatest name we have for God, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, means the God who brought the world into existence. But God exists outside of the world, before the world. We can't even fathom. We don't have a name for God outside the universe or outside the time of creation. And therefore, the rabbis say you're not allowed to ask questions as beyond the universe, before the universe. Only within the universe as we know it can we ask questions. That's why the Beis in Bereishis is closed on the top, it's closed on the bottom, closed on the back. The only place is after that Beis of Bereishis, once there's a creation, you can ask questions. Before that, it's beyond our comprehension. To ask a question, why couldn't have God created the world differently, is a question on God's mind before creation. That's something we can't fathom. The most we can understand is, once God created the world the way we know it, what can we learn from it? And God created the world in a way that people appreciate what they earn more than what they don't earn. So what can we understand about that after that's a fact? Okay. So what can we understand about it? God said, if I will shower my presence on you and put your soul in a world to come, and that will not be the ultimate goodness. So I'm putting your soul in a physical world, distanced from me, and I'm giving you the ability to make that bond with me instead of me making the bond with you. And we're here for 120 years, and we have the opportunity to not earn our world to come, but create it. People think that we earn our share in the world to come. It's like a Purim carnival. You play games. If you win, you get coupons. At the end of the day, you cash in your coupons for a prize in the prize booth. If you have a lot of coupons, you get a big bear. Got a little coupons, you get a little bear. And the same thing, we think, is what's going to be in the world to come. Here, there's games to play. They're called mitzvahs. If you do them successfully, you get coupons. Unfortunately, there are other games to play where you get demerits. And they're subtracted. After 120 years, they punch your name into this gigantic computer in the heavens, and they add up all your points, subtract all your demerits, and they give you a coupon and say, go and cash it in for a share in the world to come. It doesn't work like that. That would not be the ultimate pleasure. Prove it to you. Imagine if you were dreaming about getting this beautiful, very plush reclining chair for your birthday. You were dreaming about sitting in that chair. You could sit there for hours, days, weeks, maybe the rest of your life. Never get up. And you're hoping that your Aunt Matilda would give it to you for a present. And she comes through and she gives you this beautiful, very comfortable chair and you sit in it. You think you'd appreciate it? 100%. What happens though if Aunt Matilda decides to give you a sweater instead? And you don't get your chair. And you don't have the money to buy it, so you have to go to work 6 days a week, 8 hours a day for a month to earn enough money to buy the chair. And at the end of the month, you go and buy your chair and you sit in it. Do you think you'd appreciate it more? Of course. What happens though, if you don't buy the chair, but you plant wood, plant trees, raise them until they are able to be cut down for lumber, cut them into boards and make the frame of the chair. Mine iron, make it into nails and bang the boards together. Raise sheep, shear their wool and stuff the chair. Raise cotton, spin it into upholstery and make the upholstery of the chair. And now you sit in that chair. Do you think you'd appreciate it even more? What you earn, you appreciate more than what you're given for free. And what you create, you appreciate more than what you earn. And therefore, for the world to come to be the ultimate pleasure, we have to create it. How do we create the world to come? God gave us a example book called the Torah, which tells us which kinds of things in this world are godly and which kinds of things are not godly. or ungodly. And then we can use that as a frame of reference, an example for all the other things in life. Eating, drinking, sports, leisure, your married life, economic life. There's a way to do every single thing that's a godly way. And if you do it in a godly way, you make your soul more godly. And after 120 years, you have a greater connection, a greater bond with God that you've created. You do it in a way that's ungodly, you have less of a connection. We create our world to come, and we can do it every second in anything we're doing. Anything can be done in a godly way or an ungodly way, whatever it is. You can know God in everything you do. And knowing over here means connecting. Kol ma'asecha yulasha, everything you do, you can do with a good intention, in a godly way or an ungodly way. And with that, you create the world to come. The Gemara says there was a sinner who something inspired him intensely in the midst of a sin. And he repented. And he died because it was so intense about tshuva. And a heavenly voice resounded, Ashrecha Rebbe Lazar ben Dudoy shemuft shemesukin l'olam haba, that he got his world to come in that 1 second. When Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, the compiler of the Mishnah, Rabbeinu HaKadosh, heard this story, he cried. And he said, Yesh kona olama b'shah achas, a person can acquire his world to come in 1 second. So they asked, why was he crying? He should have been ecstatic. You can be crying of the world to come in a second. What's so terrible? What's the cry? He said, because he realized you could do that every second. There's no limit to how much world to come you can get. In mathematics, there is an infinite amount of whole numbers. There's also an infinite amount of fractions between every two whole numbers. So if in mathematics there can be an infinite amount of infinities, in Olam Haba there can be an infinite amount of eternities. And every second you can create more and more and more. And how many seconds do we let fly through our fingers and we don't create anything? All the questions I give time in the end. So, this world is a place where we can constantly create eternity. Every second of life, on any level. And from a secular standpoint, this world is important because it's a place to get pleasure. This is the place to have pleasure. As I once saw on a t-shirt they were selling in New York, the one who has the most toys when he wins, when he dies, wins. That's what it said. Toys are things that give you pleasure, experiences, objects. You're born, eventually you die, and the purpose of life is to fill up your life with toys. And the one who has the most toys had a successful life. I was looking for an asterisk for a footnote, what exactly you win at that moment since you're no longer here. Then I heard about a woman from Los Angeles who before she died asked to be buried in her Rolls Royce, not in a coffin. And the courts upheld her wish to the chagrin of her heirs, and she was buried in her Rolls Royce. She had the most expensive, biggest toy. She got to be buried in it. She won. She had a real successful life. She got to be buried in her Rolls Royce. What exactly she gained at that point? True story. I don't know if she was Jewish or not. I just know she wasn't my relative. I don't know exactly what she benefited from that. I'm sure her gas mileage at that point was great because she wasn't going anywhere. But she had the biggest toy and she won. But that's not what life is all about. And therefore, from a secular standpoint, unless you have a lot of seconds and quality of life, life is not important at all. What can you possibly, how many toys can you get in a second? None. And even if you have a lot of seconds, but you're in a coma in the hospital, how many toys can you enjoy on that level? So you need quality and quantity to make life important. There's no intrinsic value to life. It's just how much quantity and quality you have. From a Torah standpoint, you can have 1 second and you can be in a coma in the hospital. As long as you're still alive, even if the EEG says flat brain waves, that doesn't mean you're not thinking. That either means that the machine is not sensitive enough to pick it up, and in 20 years they'll make a more sensitive machine and apologize for pulling the plug. Or it means that no machine will ever pick up brain activity because there is none. But since a person's still alive, his neshama is still connected to his body, he can be thinking through his neshama. So big deal, so he can think. You can repent and change your whole eternity. You can think about doing mitzvahs that you can do without action, thinking, loving God, fearing God. And in 1 second, you can create eternity. Or you can be thinking about doing all the mitzvahs you can't do. And we have a rule that if you want to do a mitzvah and you are prevented by circumstances beyond your control, you get rewarded as if you did the mitzvah. So a person like that can do all the mitzvahs. In 1 second, on the lowest quality, you can create eternity. That's pretty special. So that is our perspective of life. Life is very important. And therefore, this is not the world to take it easy. This is a world to put in tremendous effort. When I was about 8 years old, the supermarket in my neighborhood in North Miami Beach had a contest. And the first prize was you could go through the supermarket for 15 minutes and take off the shelves for free whatever you could get. And a woman won this contest, and they invited the whole neighborhood to come and to see this woman claim her prize. So I went with my brothers. It was something to see. And I remember the woman had bought special sneakers so she could run fast through the supermarket and grab as much as she could. And she had 2 carts, one on each arm, so she didn't run out of space to put these things in. And this was before GPSs. This was about 50 years ago, maybe more. And she had, what's it called, more than 50 years ago, she had a contraption connected to her head with a map of the supermarket in front of her with the more expensive places marked off. So she'd go to them first. They told her, lady, we're going to blow a whistle and say, ready, get set, go. And you have 15 minutes. Whatever you grab off the shelves then is yours. And exactly 15 minutes to the second, we're going to blow another whistle, and if you grab anything then, it's ours. They say, ready, get set, go. They blow the whistle. She starts running, I remember, like a meshuggah. Running through the aisles, grabbing everything she could. Within 5 minutes, she was sweating profusely, breathing heavy. Imagine if somebody would have gone to her and said, lady, you look really tired and out of breath. Here's a chair, have a seat, sit for a while. You know what she'd say? Are you out of your mind? I have 15 minutes. Come 15 minutes from now, bring me the chair, I'll sit here for the rest of my life. But not now. That's this world. This world's not a place to take it easy. Because you only have 15 minutes. 120 years, believe me. You're all young people. So by you, everything seems like it goes very, very slowly. In fact, now you're thinking this is taking forever. But when you get to be my age, everything goes by very quickly. One Shabbos just blurs to the next Shabbos. And forget about Shabbos, years blur to years. So the whole 120 years, another 15 minutes. And you can grab what you can. Every second, create more eternity. And there's no time to take a rest. The rest is only to grab more. Right? So this world is a very, very special place. And every second is very special. Every second is eternal. That is the present HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us. Rotz HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lezakos. He wanted to purify our souls. He saw that we have the potential to have that relationship with Him more than any other nation in the world. They also have a relationship, but it's not the same relationship. And since our souls are of a different nature, we can purify them where our relationship with God is like a parent and a child. Them, it's a little bit more distant. And therefore God gave us an abundance of Torah and mitzvahs to be able to create that bond everywhere we turn. It's a tremendous benefit. And therefore we can understand the following sentence in the Torah. If you understand the Torah is a present, it's an opportunity, it is not a liability. Torah says the following, Mo Hashem Elokecha Shalom. What does God want from you already? So you would think what follows is a few measly things. You know what the end of that sentence is? Mo Hashem Elokecha, what does God want from you already? Ki im only, Liyiras Hashem Elokecha, to fear Him, to love Him, to walk in all His ways, to do all His mitzvahs and all His commandments, and only a million things. Doesn't make sense. The answer is the last two words in the sentence. L'tov loch. It's for your good. God doesn't want anything from you. He wants to give you an opportunity. He's not asking for anything. He's giving you an opportunity. It's all for your good. It's not for his good. He doesn't need it. He wants to give you that tremendous merit and that tremendous opportunity. I think this is the mistake that the Goyim made. And they didn't get the Torah because of that. When God offered the Torah to the non-Jewish world, they asked, what's in it? And God told each one something a little difficult for them. He says, you can't murder. Esau said, we live by the sword. How can we not murder? God left them, went to the Yishmaelim. They asked also, what's in it? He said, you can't steal. You can't steal. We have a bracha that our hands in everybody's pocket, their hands in our pocket. God left them, came to the Jewish people. We said, give it. It always bothered me. The Goyim didn't say no. They said they had a problem. Why didn't God explain to them that there is no problem? You can live by the sword and not murder. Living by the sword means you'll be mercenaries, soldiers of fortune. You'll fight other people's battles. That's not murder. That's wartime. Now, do you want the Torah or not? You can have your bracha and you can have the Torah. You can have your cake and eat it. Do you want it or not? Why do you leave them abruptly? I was thinking perhaps the answer is the following. If I had come here today and said, I hate to do this, but I really need a favor. Could you do me a favor? How would you answer? If you're the nicest people in the world, what would you have to say first? What do you want? You couldn't say, oh, sure. Maybe I want somebody to carry my car home because I don't have any gas. Right? Maybe you can't do that. Maybe I need a $1 million interest-free loan for the next 99 years. Maybe you can't do that. If you can, see me after this year. Maybe you can't do that. So you'd have to ask me, well, what do you want? And then you could decide if you could do it or not. But what if I came here today and I said, really, I was here last year and this mission is really something special and I wanted to show you my gratitude for your inviting me and how much I appreciate what you're doing. And I brought you this beautiful present and it's gift wrapped with a bow and I give it to you. Would anybody here say, what is it? No, you take it graciously. When I turn my back, you'd look fast to see what it was. Right? That's the way you take a present. Why? Because what difference does it make what it is? It's a present. Take it. You don't like it, give it to somebody else. But it's a present. Take it. You don't ask what it is. When God offered the Torah to the nations of the world, they thought he was asking them to do him a favor. It's a liability. So they asked, what's in it? And God gave them the benefit of the doubt and said, maybe they're just curious. She told them something a little difficult. They said, you know what, we can't do you the favor. It would mean giving up a blessing that we have. We can't do you the favor. God said, if you think I'm asking you to do me a favor, then there's nothing to talk about. The Jewish people said, give it. We'll find out what it is later. It's a present. We understood it's a present. In fact, they say a joke. When God offered the Torah to the nations of the world, they said, what's in it? When he offered it to the Jewish people, they said, how much does it cost? God said, it's free. Free will take 10. But it's not far from the truth. We understood it's a present. And therefore, we accepted it sight unseen. You want to give us a present? Give us the present. The nations of the world understood it's a liability. It's a liability. First tell us what it is. We'll see if we can do it or not. But is it really true? It sounds very nice. Torah is a present. It's an opportunity. It's not a liability. It's not a yoke. But Rashi seems to disagree with me. Because there's a Rashi a few places in the Talmud that explains a phrase that the Gemara uses. Mitzvahs lav lehenas nitnu. Mitzvahs were not given for physical pleasure. But Rashi adds, so what were they given for? Ela l'ol al tzavoreinu. They are a yoke around our neck. Now that does not sound like a present, an opportunity. That sounds like a yoke around our neck. It sounds like a liability. So which is it? I'll tell you another thing. In one place the Torah says that if we don't keep the Torah with a lot of effort and omol v'yegia, effort and putting in tremendous amount of work, then we're going to go into galus. In another place the Torah says if we don't keep the Torah with tremendous simcha, we're going to go into galus. Those two things don't seem to go together. Effort and work don't seem to go together with joy. Now the answer is they go together very nicely. Imagine if you had a lottery that the first prize was $1 million. But each lottery ticket cost $10,000. And you had to put in a tremendous amount of work to buy that ticket. But there's only one ticket. And if you buy the $10,000 ticket, you automatically can exchange it for $1 million. Would anybody complain about how much work they had to put in for the $10,000? Or the sacrifice? No. You're exchanging this for this. When the Torah tells us all these mitzvahs, yes, it involves a tremendous amount of investment and work and effort, but it's worth it. Somebody gives you a treasure map, tells you where a tremendous amount of treasure is to be found, but it's somewhere in the Andes. You have to dig through solid rock for 6 months and get there and invest tremendous amount of money to dig up this treasure. A lot of work. Is it worth it? Yeah. Is it easy? No. But is a person giving you a liability or a benefit? He's giving you a benefit. Does it involve a tremendous amount of effort, a tremendous amount of investment? Yes. Is it worth it? Yes. We live in a society where everything has to be fun. That's how we raise our children. And we give them this idea that Torah is fun. Right? You have sit sometimes with my grandchildren in front of a computer screen with Uncle Moshe on the screen. And nothing against Uncle Moshe. I know him personally. He's a nice man. But the message sometimes is, Torah is fun. It's so much fun to be a mitzvah girl and a mitzvah boy, and mitzvahs are such fun. That lasts till you're about 3. Because when you're 3, and you say, Mommy, or 4, I want an ice cream cone. And Mommy says, but you just had a meat meal. You can't have an ice cream cone, you gotta wait 1 hour or 6 hours. And the kid says, wait a second, you said that mitzvahs are fun. It's not fun to wait 1 hour for an ice cream cone. What is this? You lied to me. Mitzvahs are not fun. Now, I'll tell you a little secret. There are a lot of mitzvahs that are a lot less fun than waiting 1 hour for an ice cream cone. Believe me, if you're not familiar with them. Try Yom Kippur, try Pesach, try family purity. They are not easy mitzvahs. They're not fun. I saw it in the Modia about 2 years ago, that the Israeli orange growers produced a new genetically engineered orange. They invested millions of dollars in it. And when they were asked, well, what do you need a new orange? What was wrong with the old orange? They said, we have to please our clientele. People want things fast and easy. And we had to produce an orange that is fast to peel, has a very thin skin, and easy to eat. It has no pits. Because people today want things fast and easy. And people want Torah like that too. All of a sudden, Gemara became computer games. Not something you sit and break your head over. It's a game. It's fun. Torah is fun. It is not fun. Not fun at all. But is it worth it? Yes. That's what we should teach our children. Torah is not easy. And it takes investment. It takes effort. But is it worth it? Yeah, it's worth it. Is it worth putting the effort every second? Yeah, because you create eternity. So if you learn the breadth and the depth of what Torah is, and you appreciate what life is, and how important every second is, and if you put in the effort, you are the beneficiary. You're creating eternity every second that you fulfill a mitzvah or do something according to the spirit of what Torah and mitzvahs are. So there's no one benefiting more than you are. And if you appreciate that, and it's clear to you, then you can influence other people. You can't sell something you don't believe in. A salesman has to believe in his product. If you want to inspire others, first you have to inspire yourself. First you have to fill your cup. Fill your cup with information, your Jewish Yiddish cup, and fill your cup with wine, your emotional status also. When you are convinced, and when you know enough information to give over, so your cup runs over, then you can fill up a lot of other Jewish cups. So you're here in Eretz Yisrael to imbibe the atmosphere here. The atmosphere in Eretz Yisrael is inspiring. If you want it to be, you can turn yourself off to anything. But if you want to open your ears and your eyes and your heart, the atmosphere here has a lot to give you by osmosis. In addition, you have all these fine classes to fill your heads with a lot of information and a lot of inspiration. And then you can take that all back and let it flow to others so it can become infectious in a very positive way, right? And bring other people to appreciate what life is all about and how Torah makes life valuable, not fun, but easy, and not easy, but worthwhile, and makes the 120 years that we have in this world not only important because we're filling them with toys, but important because we are creating eternity. And that eternity we benefit from, and all those around us benefit from. If we understand that, then you'll go home, Taka, strengthened, and you'll strengthen others. And Emir Hashem, in your schus, it was in the schus of women who were strengthened and strengthened others that we got out of Egypt to begin with, and that we've lasted through this long galus. And it's in the merit of women as yourselves that eventually, soon as possible, Mashiach will come and take us out of this galus, and all of you will be able to come back here and live in Eretz Yisrael, not only come to visit Eretz Yisrael, be able to live here and enjoy what it means to be able to attach yourself to this very holy and special land, Lenetzach Nitzachim, for eternity. V'yaskoel tzedek m'heirav yomein.